Sai.
Spend the day with Sai.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. on Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Welcome, dear listeners, to this week's afternoon satsang. As always, this is Prem from Team Radio Sai with Arvind, and we are going to continue the session that we started last time. As we said, we are supposed to be doing the Bhagavata Vahini satsang this time, but we are extending the topic that we were talking about last time, which is actually a beautiful question answer session that Swami had in East Africa when he was talking to a group of doctors. And we found the questions and answers quite interesting, and we thought it would be very fruitful for all of us to go through what Swami had to say and probably discuss a little bit about what Swami had said in reply to those questions. So we thought we'll continue with that. There will be a little bit of flow. So to continue that session, and before we do that, as always, we'll offer a humble pranam to Swami's lotus feet, and let's ask Arvind to join all of us. Sairam Arvind.
Sairam Prem. And once again, it's such a pleasure and privilege to be going through these questions, because these are answers that Bhagwan himself has given. And, I've often experienced this, that when Swami gives an answer, two levels of answering happens. One is the direct answer that is there that Bhagwan is giving. And the second is, as you listen to Swami's answer, or as you read Swami's answer, whichever it might be, whether you're reading it from a book or hearing it on audio, when you are assimilating the answer based on your spiritual evolution, the way that answer has to apply to you hits you. That is why, you know, the same discourse is inspiring to people of different ages, people of different spiritual outlook, different attitude, all kinds of differences. It appeals to the diversity in different ways. And people start doing different things based on the same discourse. On the face of it, you may wonder, how is it that you are inspired to do this, while you are inspired to do that, while the third person is inspired to do the third thing, when all of you have heard the same discourse? I feel that is the speciality of the avatar, wherein he definitely gives the answer, but the answer also has a subtle component which makes it applicable for each individual based on his or her own spiritual level or spiritual need. And that is why I say I'm very, very excited to be part of this question answer session, where the answers are given by Bhagwan himself.
And I recall we had done one satsang on the master's touch. Mm. And in that time if you recall, it was a collection of quotations which describe who a master is. And one of the things which we discussed about that is this. You know, a scholar will answer your questions, but a master can answer you. And that's what all the difference is, because it's precisely what you were saying, that it does not merely answer the intellectual nature of the question, but it even answers the real inquisitiveness behind the question itself.
The root. Right, it answers the root.
So many times I feel we may relate to that question completely, but sometimes we would find that probably the answer does not correlate to the question at all. But Swami will answer in such a way that it really addresses the person who's asking the question. In fact, I recall someone was telling that Swami was giving an interview to a class of girls who are passing out or something like that. Mm-hmm. And this is not Anantapur, I think another college. Swami had called them for an interview. Mm-hmm. And the lecturer of that group, she was telling, there was this one girl in that group who had a very troubled family background. Mm-hmm. She had lost her mother and father had remarried. And going against the Bollywood plot, the second mother she got was a very, very noble lady who showered a lot of love on her, but she was never able to accept her. And she would trouble that mother a lot, right? Mm. And so much so that the parents were very worried about her. And everybody in her class knew about it. They tried to counsel her about it, but it didn't help. So this girl asked this question to Swami. And she said, Swami, what should we do to ensure that we get a husband as noble as probably like someone like Lord Rama? And you know what Swami's reply to that? I mean, you could give any reply, right? It's such a general question. And Swami said, if your nature is like that of Ravana, is like that of Surpanaka, you will get a husband who has a demonic nature. If your nature is like Sita, you will get a husband who is like Lord Rama. Right? This was a very simple answer which Swami gave. But this girl, she took it literally that Swami is referring to her behavior with her, you know, mother, who was actually very kind to her. And that changed her completely. So the beauty of, you know, the question may be completely unrelated, and, you know, intellectually we might come up with a better answer. But Swami's answers are special because for this one reason.
So with that, dear listeners, I think we will go to the next question, continuing from where we had left off last week. I remember last week, the last question we had discussed was about how parents, you know, should inspire children, and when children are going awry, how do you pull them back? How do you get them interested in spirituality? It's not as if this question is related to that, but just for the sake of continuity, I mentioned what was the last question last week. This week, I think the first question we'll be dealing with is when Swami was asked why he performs miracle. I mean, whether it is for a kind of a show to show that he is beyond nature and he can break the laws of nature. I think that was the question.
Right. I think we'll, as we did last time, we'll read out the question and the answer, and then we'll discuss what Swami is giving in reply. The question was, Swamiji, you are performing miracles. What is the purpose? Is it good for the people to know that the laws of nature can be broken? Swami's reply was, no, no, I do not perform miracles. Of course, there are some who perform feats. They have acquired some powers through yoga, and they go about displaying them in order to collect money or influence or followers or reputation. They indulge in pradarshana or exhibition. What you call miracles are just spontaneous evidences of my divinity. I have not acquired the power to perform them, nor do I exhibit them for demonstrating my divinity. In fact, so far as you and I are concerned, miracles are not important at all. Pay more attention to other things about me. When a son comes home for the holidays and is about to leave for college, the mother prepares a big feast with all the nice dishes he likes most. She does so out of sheer love, not to draw the son nearer to herself or to impress upon him her talent in the culinary art. Her love is reflected back from the son as love. I too express my love, and that expression is a nidarshana or evidence of divine power which induces you to take the Godward path. I do not set about to perform what you call miracles. It is my nature. It is my way of doing things. My way of expressing my love and grace.
Beautiful. When Swami is saying that his performing of miracles is nidarshana, it just means that it's a spontaneous expression of his love. Just like a mother, he himself has given the example, cooks a feast for the son. You know, and Swami also says that these miracles, no, they are just like his nature. It's his nature. It's the nature of divine to be miraculous. It's not done for any show off, or it's not done for any kind of to attract things. Because it's like, when you say it's nature, it's like the most common example that comes to my mind is the nature of fire is to be hot. So fire doesn't become hot to show its capabilities or to show its might or for anything. It's its nature to be hot, and that is the nature of divine, to be miraculous. It's not for the sake of any show or to prove a point or for anything else. As Swami would say, miracles are just my calling cards. And what does a calling card do? Calling card gives a kind of first introduction to a person. My visiting card, if I give my visiting card to somebody, that is my basic first introduction to the person. And there will be my email ID, my phone number, and my other details, using which he can get to know me better. That is how Swami says, you know, the first step in this journey towards Sakshatkar, which is ultimate merger in the divine, it begins with Chamatkar. So, Chamatkar is just like a visiting card, a first brief introduction to divinity.
And, you know, contrasting what Swami is telling about, I mean, Swami played with the question itself, because the question of Swami, why do you perform miracles? And Swami said, I do not perform, right? When you say performance, it means you are exhibiting something, and Swami said it's not an exhibition. Contrasting that with what Swami would tell about the human aspect of himself, Swami would say that, you know, sometimes Swami will ask you, what is your name, where do you come from? And Swami would say, Atla natistunnano, Swami would say.
Like
Swami said, I pretend as though I do not know anything. So actually that is the performance, right? acting human is what Swami is.
What we consider performing as natural is right. The performance.
That is the performance from Swami.
In fact, when you say that, it reminds me of the other thing that Swami would say. He would say, what is Ascharyam for you is Sahajam right. for me, and what is Sahajam for you is actually what I'm acting. You know, what we think of him as being human, which is normal, that is something that he's putting on.
Right,
and what we feel amazed, wow, this is miraculous, that is natural, Sahajam for him.
Right. And how many times we would see that, you know, Swami will be pretending as though he doesn't know anything, and suddenly that you know, as beautifully they would say, that veil of Maya just parts a little and gives you a glimpse even before you can see it completely, it again, you know, closes. That's what Swami would do. I mean, so many experiences we have heard where Swami would do something which is so miraculous, but the very next moment he will, you know, show some kind of limitation in himself, and we would fall for it still.
And we would enjoy falling for it, so that will help to build a conversation.
Right.
Because as I say, I'm grateful to Maya, because if not for Maya, we would not have the pleasure of interacting with God.
Absolutely.
Answering his
right.
questions. You know, also speaking of performance, I remember, you know, I was watching one of these shows that come on television, Penn and Teller. These are supposed to be two great
right.
magicians. And because they are supposed to be the greatest magicians of our times, the challenge is, can you fool them?
Fool them, right.
And so different magicians come and they do it. And one thing that is common to all these magicians, you know, those who are normal, first of all those who come on the show are above normal there, and those who are brilliant, everybody have one thing in common: they are great showmen.
Performers.
Or show women. Yeah, they're performers. Because, you know, you can, when the crux of their magic is coming, they ensure that the music rises up to a crescendo, and you know, lights start focusing there, a smoke comes. They all ensure, they want to make sure that all the thousands who are watching should not miss this. In sharp contrast, you know, when you look at Swami, the other day again I was watching some footage that we have. We are blessed by Bhagwan to have an archive with such beautiful footage, one of the old Dasara Yagnams. Swami is performing the Purnahuti, and for the Purnahuti, that cloth bundle has been prepared, which has to be lowered into the sacrificial fire, into the Yagna Kunda. And Swami picks up this bag, and even as he is lowering it into the Yagna Kunda, quickly by the side of his bag, he just waves his palm in two quick circles, small quick circles, palm facing downward, materializes, I don't know, you can't even see it because it's so fast. I'm just thinking possibly a few gemstones. Just adds them into the bag and puts them into the Yagna Kunda, you know. And among those 35 odd priests and scholars who are surrounding him chanting the Vedas, one person happens to just notice it, and he just raises an eyebrow like, hey, something is going on there. That's all. I was just thinking, Swami, what you have done there is such an amazing thing. Wouldn't you want at least those 35 priests to see? Because if when they see it, they're surely going to drop their jaw in awe, you know. But even as this thought came, the countering thought that came was, hey, let me not forget that Swami is God. He's not a magician. He doesn't want to show to impress or anything. He does it because it's his nature. It has to be done. I mean, I'm sure if there was nobody in the Kulwant Hall, I mean, nobody in that Purnachandra auditorium watching the Yagna also, and Swami was alone doing the Purnahuti, he would have still done that because he just does. He has to do it. He did it. And, you know, this is really a big distinguishing factor between, as Swami says, Pradarshana and Nidarshana, between a performance of a miracle versus just being the miracle, because that's your swabhava or nature.
And, you know, the interesting thing is, you know, even as you're talking about Swami doing something so that it can be shown, even as we were students, if Swami does something in public, it is actually a greater thing than what Swami does in private. Because in public, Swami pretty much would be as normal as he would. I mean, except for those few things like the Lingodbhavam, and probably in the 60s when Swami used to do that Vibhuti Abhishekam. And the Vibhuti and the chain and rings which Swami would materialize in the open. Actually speaking, if you were to list out what Swami has done in the form of miracle, these were the least exciting of what Swami has done, right? And Swami would not do more than this outside. Most of what Swami has done, which is like mind-boggling, has happened in that interview room with probably three people, two people, one person to witness.
Oh yes, creating a monkey, tapping the wall and sending a person to Australia.
Right, and you know, creating a ring and changing its color with every blow, which you can't deny, you know, it's happening right in front of your eye. One way of looking at it is Swami did it in a crowd where which was one or two people. There was not enough people to, you know, vouch for what Swami did. But from Swami's point of view, when you don't do it for a show, you don't do look for audience, right? When Swami says it's equivalent to a mother who cooks a beautiful, you know, meal for a child who's going away after vacation. I mean, that's what Swami's spontaneousness in the interview room. All kinds of things Swami did because it was just an expression of Swami's love.
I think with that, we'll come to a close of that question and move on to the next question, which is regarding karma. You know, and I think this will be very interesting because all of us have this question about karma. You know, if karma is such a binding thing and nobody can escape one's karma, it is destiny. What is the use of doing good? A similar kind of question I think was asked to Bhagwan.
So we'll go through that question and the answer and then we'll discuss. The question was, excuse me, Swamiji, for this question, if one has to suffer the consequences of karma, whatever he has thought, spoken and done, what is the good of bhajans, prayers, etc.? So the question is pretty similar to what you were saying, that what is the point in doing good actions if you anyway have to suffer your karma? So the answer that Swami gave was, as you say, one has to reap the consequences. Every act, every thought, every word has its inevitable impact. But from the previous life, only the impact of the major and the more forceful acts and karmas are carried over to this life. The effects of every little karma are not to be suffered from birth to birth. Besides, you must remember another point, which is encouraging. It is possible by means of repentance, contrition and consistent good living to counteract the evil consequences. More than all, the grace of God is all-powerful. It can make the law of karma ineffective in your case. His grace can make the consequence of His grace can make the consequence of no consequence. The doctors among you know that certain drugs are dated. When the date elapses, the drug is ineffective, though it is to all appearance the same, unchanged in quantity, color or other characteristics. So too, the consequences of karma may be in the bottle, but it can do no harm, it can produce no effect. Or, when a person is under morphine, the pain is there, but he is unaware of it. So, when the grace of God is won, the consequence of karma might work itself out, but the person will be unaffected. So, it is as good as cancellation. Karma cannot harass you when you are under the benign influence of divine grace. Illness can be cured and health can be restored, is it not? Similarly, suffering due to past actions, thoughts and words can be cured and equanimity restored.
So beautiful here, because I think Swami answers different aspects of the same question. The person who asked the question didn't ask it as comprehensively the way Swami answered it. First of all, Swami assures that, you know, just like an illness can be cured, I mean, this is how Swami concluded his answer, but Swami assures that just like an illness can be cured with medicine, karma can be cured with God's grace. That is the assurance that is there. Now, you know, when we speak of karma, we just think that what we have done in the past is going to affect us in the present and future, and we are, you know, stuck with that. So, one thing that Swami says is, you don't have to worry about having to face the reaction across lifetimes, because only some major karmas are transferred to the next lives. Many of the minor things, I think, they get done in this life only. In fact, I remember in many discourses, Swami would therefore say that when sorrow or pain or something, suffering comes to you, welcome it. Welcome it and know that na sukhat labhyate sukham. From joy you don't get joy, it's from pain you get joy. One way of viewing that is, possibly all this pain is coming because all my karmas are getting nullified in this birth itself. I need not carry it over to next birth. So that is one thing that Swami says, that you don't have to worry, all karmas don't carry over to the next birth. And even in karmas that carry over to the next birth, Swami says that there is this chance of expiry date. With time, karmas also lose potency. So that is another divine assurance that he gives. And finally, if these two are not enough, Swami gives another beautiful assurance saying that even if it has not lost potency and if it is going to, you know, cause effect on you, God's grace can come to you like the way morphine injection or a painkiller injection acts. And it's such a perfect example because it's all doctors out there. So he says that though you're in pain, you don't feel the pain because of the morphine. In the same way, though you're undergoing karma, because you have God's grace, you don't feel the impact or suffer due to that karma. So it's a very comprehensive reassurance which must be calming for all of us as well.
And pretty much what happens to most devotees, when you grow in devotion, I mean, a simple example is, I think when we were all children, we must have been scared of the injection, right? So let's say that I had to take an injection when I was an 8-year-old boy, and I forgot to take that, and now when I'm 20, they come to me, 20 or 30, they come and say, that now you take that injection which you missed out then. I would not be as worried about that injection now compared to how worried I would have been when I was an 8-year-old boy.
Because now you're grown in...
Right, now you're grown...
In maturity and wisdom.
Right. The same thing happens even in a devotee. You know, you might still be probably facing a loss in business at one point, but you have grown in devotion to accept that loss with equanimity much, much more now than if it had happened 10 years back. And that's what Swami says, with grace, you have the feeling that, you know, it is acceptable because it is coming through Swami, it's acceptable to me. And the moment it loses its sting, then what is karma after all? It is just an event which is happening in your life.
With regard to karma and God's grace, I'm reminded of another analogy. I read it from a website where, again, this was another question answer session with Swami, not an officially recorded one, but the answer is so amazing that it has to be of divine origin, you know. Swami says that when you go to a bank, I think here he was speaking to a commerce kind of guy, you know, so he's giving another example. Here he gave of morphine. Here he's saying when you go to a bank, it is your own money there. Okay, it is your own money, but you simply can't go to a bank and demand it. You can't. You have to write a check and sign it. Today, of course, it's not there, it's digital, but still, you have to log in, you have to put in a one-time password from your phone. Basically, yeah.
Right, even though it's your money, you need to identify yourself.
Yes, you need to, you need to. So, what Swami says there is, the check leaf is the check of sacrifice. And the signature of love. He says, though it is your own, so Swami says, grace of God, it belongs to you. I'm sorry. What Swami says is the merit, that is your deposit in the bank, it belongs to you, but to withdraw your own merit onto yourself, you need to have sacrifice and love. And then again Swami says, how can you withdraw if you have deposits in the bank? So Swami says, that is the good that you have done in this life. If you have done good in this life, if you have made regular deposits, when you need, with sacrifice and love, that deposit you can withdraw. You can withdraw it as God's grace. That is a merit. When you withdraw it, it comes to you as God's grace on you. What if you have not done anything? What if you have not made any deposits? He says, you can still go to a bank where you have no account, no deposits. You can pledge your land, your gold, your other, what assets you have made. Swami says, that is like your purva janma punyas, the merits that you have done in previous births. You can pledge them and in return for that you can get grace from God. But what if you have done neither? You know, we often feel that we are prisoners of our past. I am enjoying because possibly I did good before or I have done good in the immediate past, in this birth. But what if I have not done? Don't I have any hope? Swami says, if you neither have deposits nor have assets, if you can get a guarantor, a wealthy person, a businessman, somebody rich who says that, no, I trust him, I stand by him, the bank will still give you money. If you have a guarantor who stands by you. And Swami says, that guarantor is God, that guarantor is your guru. If you are able to procure, if you are able to offer yourself to a guru or to God, who is the Satguru always, when he stands as guarantor, though you have nothing against your name, grace will be granted to you. Because it is so beautiful because Swami says, once you place your faith in God and Guru, the Guru and God place their faith in you. That is why though you have no deposits, they are ready to release grace. So, you know, this analogy is so beautiful because it shows that it's not that we are a prisoner of the past. Though we have not done any good so far, it's not late to begin. We start with surrendering to the Guru, it can all be turned around.
Right. Since you narrated that with a little sense of, ambiguity, you're not sure it is Swami. It is from Swami because this is repeated by Swami on many occasions.
And, oh, wonderful.
One
okay.
Which I've heard is from Bhagya sir. Okay. He was telling when he was talking, Swami was talking to students, he gave this very example.
Okay.
And these many ways of withdrawing money. And during that conversation, there's a little extension of that which I recall.
Huh.
When Bhagya sir said, Swami, there's one more way you can take money from the bank.
What is that?
And he said, Swami, an overdraft.
Okay.
Right? Huh. Where if you have a good track record with the bank, even though you don't have the money in your name, the bank can allow you to take a little extra money, you know, believing that you will repay it. So Swami was very immediate in responding to that. Swami said, hey, you are a teacher, so you know how that works. You know, and Swami explained, when do you give a grace mark to a student? Will you give a grace mark to a student who has got 5 out of 100 and make him pass? You will only give grace mark to a student who has got 35 or 38, give him 5 of those 2 marks and make him pass. So Swami says, that is what overdraft will work like. If you have a good track record, the teacher would say that, you know, he has done well, probably he can learn the little bit of things which he missed out without failing this exam. So Swami said, like that, God will look at your track record. And Swami will say that, you have anyway learned the lesson. You know, what is the whole idea of you going through the bad karma that you've done? Is to learn from the mistake that you've made. So Swami said, if God is convinced that you've learned the lesson, or you will learn it eventually, then God will let you pass.
Beautiful.
With a grace mark.
And you know, this, it makes it very clear that you need not feel trapped if you have not done anything so far. It's not too late to begin. Even now you can begin. It's like, you know, in a modern day context when somebody says, oh, internet, I don't know anything about the internet. Oh, you don't know? 20 years, you know, internet has changed our lives. Oh God, I'm so late, you know. If somebody says that and feels that it's too late now, I'm 20 years late, what will your answer be? No man, you're not late. Even begin now. Even start learning now, you'll start benefiting from now on about the internet. So it's not like you're late, so you lose out the benefits. In the same way, it's never too late. In fact, anytime you begin, the grace pours on you. I am reminded of a very beautiful episode which I heard from one of our brothers.
Mm-hmm.
Harish Krishan, actually, he was my classmate, and he got the opportunity to serve Swami for some few years. And his father-in-law has narrated this incident.
Okay.
And it goes like this. In the 1990s, when the super speciality hospital was opened in Prashanthiliam, it was something that took everyone's breath away, because nobody imagined in their wildest dreams that something like this could be conceived and executed and be running, up and running. So with great joy, everybody, you know, from different states, all the state presidents, everyone, they found this to be a kind of a solution. If anybody is having terrible problems, health problems, they just direct them to the super speciality hospital in Prashanthiliam. That was the only super speciality that time.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of patients started coming. So much so that even to this day, our super speciality hospitals, both of them, they have a long list, they have a long waiting list. That time it was only one hospital, and the waiting list became so huge. So many times it would happen that patients come here, but they're just not able to, because how much can one hospital do?
Right.
So such patients, what would happen is they would just think that, no, having come to Parthi, I'm not able to get into the hospital. Let me go to Mandir. Because, you know, Swami can heal me. So a lot of sick people would gather in the Darshan hall, hoping for a miraculous cure of their ailment. When Swami noticed this, he called all the coordinators for different state organizations, and it was like an open interview in the portico. So what Swami said there was very interesting. He said, see, different people, when they come with health ailments, you send them to Puttaparthi, and the hospital is not able to accommodate all of them, and all of them come here hoping that I will cure them. How can I cure them like that? Some said, instead of sending them here like this, what you do is advise them to take up some sadhana, advise them to do some seva. So after doing that, let them come here, because then when I see them and when they pray to me, I will see the account that they have built up, the seva that they have done, the good sadhana that they have done. In lieu of that sadhana and seva, I will take care of them. I will heal them. You know, this is what Swami told. So all these coordinators went back to their respective states, and they spread the word again to the districts everywhere that, you know, this is the thing. So simply don't direct them to super speciality hospital. At that time, this father-in-law, this uncle, he was I'll call him Krishnan Uncle. This Krishnan Uncle was working at NTPC, National Thermal Power Corporation in Madhya Pradesh.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a big public owned company. I think coal and, yeah, they
mine coal.
Mine coal and generate power, you know, mm-hmm. thermal power plants. So there he had one servant, male servant, let's call him Ramesh. So this Ramesh was a very sincere person. He would help so many different officers and lead his life. One day he comes and tells this Krishnan uncle that, you know, my eyesight is failing me and I'm not able to see things and it's deteriorating over the past 2 months. So when they get it checked, they find out that the corrective treatment for that will require him to pay 2 lakh rupees.
Mm-hmm.
And they said it should be done immediately because otherwise in a month's time, he may get completely blind. Now, 2 lakhs was a big sum even, I'm talking of the 1990s.
Mm.
Even for a person working in a managerial capacity in that big corporation, for him also 2 lakhs was big. And for this Ramesh, he must have been earning something like 4,000 rupees or 3,000 rupees a month. 2 lakhs is beyond his wildest dreams. So, the first thing that came was, can they do it in Prashanthi Nilayam, Puttaparthi? But at that time, Krishna uncle, he remembers what message had been given. So he told him that, you don't worry, you know, Swami will take care. Why don't you come to our Samiti for Thursday bhajans? You know, this is how he thought he will pull him in. So he started coming. So this Ramesh started attending. And after he attended bhajans for 2 weeks, he became so happy that he began to even take part in the seva activities, whatever, with his failing eyesight.
Okay.
And a month passed. By now he should have gone completely blind. He had not gone blind. And Ramesh in his heart was crediting it to Swami. Mm-hmm. He's saying that it's because Swami have not gone blind. Another month passed, 2 months passed, 3 months passed. By now, you know, Krishnan uncle's wife, she got little upset and worried. And she just told him that, you know, he seems to be banking entirely on us doing something and we taking care. Because he has stopped, you know, bothering about mm-hmm. what is going to happen. Don't you think you should do something now? It's almost been 3 months. And he, you know, Krishnan uncle also got worried. So they got him checked. When they got him checked, they found out that whatever that disease was, its progress has stopped, you know.
Mm.
So he has not improved, but he has not deteriorated either.
Okay.
And that itself was a thrilling thing for this Ramesh.
Mm.
So he was very happy. And but though this was thrilling, they know that sometime or the other it has to be done. By God's grace it has stopped deterioration, but the treatment has to be done. The next day happened to be this uncle's birthday, and he gets a call from a friend whom he has been out of touch for a long time so far. This friend's name is Raghunath. And this Raghunath calls him and they start speaking and they start reminiscing the old days, everything. And it's not Raghunath, it's Dr. Raghunath.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Raghunath says that he is now an eye specialist, an eye surgeon, and he's working in Shankar Netralaya. Okay, Shankar Netralaya is a charity-based hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And the moment he hears eye surgeon, Shankar Netralaya, Krishna uncle says, can you give me a birthday gift? He says, what is a birthday gift? He says, and then he tells him about Ramesh. He says, Lazi is very sincere. He does so much. He participates in all seva activities. He does all this so nicely. And he has got some problem like this. Luckily, nothing has happened, but we don't want it to become worse. When Dr. Raghunath hears this, he is inspired and he says, you know what, we do a lot of free operations. It's not that everything is free, but we subsidized.
Mm-hmm.
We subsidize operations against others. So a surgeon who performs has his own recommendation quota.
Mm-hmm.
He says that I'll take up this case.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happened. Within 2-3 weeks, Ramesh was operated upon, fully fine. And after that, years passed, he became an integral part. He has not even seen Swami physically.
Mm-hmm.
He has become an integral part of the seva organization there. And best thing is, he goes around telling, any problem you have, just do seva.
Mm-hmm.
Once you do seva, God will take care of you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, see, I feel this is so amazing because when Swami says something, it's about the principle. It's not like Swami said it, that time Swami was there, now Swami is not there, what will happen? Because Ramesh here didn't even have to come to Prashanthi. He was there. He just followed Swami's word because the avatar's word, that is the avatar actually. Avatar is not just the physical frame. It is the word. Because if it was just the physical frame, then the avatar is not eternal. But avatars are eternal because the word that they give is eternal. It holds good across times, across continents, across everything. And, you know, this is an amazing incident, I feel, which shows whatever be your karma, Once you take the first step and you have the grace of God, it can be completely obliterated and overcome.
And many times, you know, when we talk of devotion, this question is there, is God just a witness, or does he involve himself in, you know, in trying to help you out of your things? It finally comes down to, you know, what is the role that you give him in your life? You know, many times, going back to the same banking analogy, sometimes you have a bank account. The bank has no role in it except to keep your money, right? You put it, you take it out, you spend it the way you want. You take it out, invest it somewhere based on what you know and what you think is best. I think pretty much our good and bad is like that relationship, right? You know, God is just a banker who's a witness. He just sees your money coming in and going. But if you want the bank to start playing the role of probably a wealth management, what a person who does wealth management does for you, now he'll start actively suggesting, you know, this is where you need to put your money, this is where you have to do. But if you, you know, there are some cases where the wealth management company has complete, you know, control over the money of the person whom they're handling, because there's so much of trust within the two. And this person ensures that, you know, this is the return I will give you. You don't have to worry about your money. You just, whatever you earn, you leave it to me. I will take care of, I'll ensure that it grows over these many years. I think that's the same relationship we sometimes have with Swami. Most of the time, as we have said many times, we want control over what happens to us, right? You know, I have done seva, I have done bhajans, but this is how I want my return. When we say that, it becomes like we are making God only a witness, only that banker who takes money and, you know, stamps it into your account, and then when you withdraw, he gives it back to you. But if you want Swami to actively start guiding your life, you need to have that trust in Swami, and that's what in devotion we call faith, right?
And surrender.
And surrender, right.
Beautifully put, Prem. I think at this point in time, dear listeners, we will take a little break. Don't go anywhere, because on the other side of this break, we'll be back and we will continue with some more very, very interesting questions.
Dayasagara, 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 Dayasagara,
Welcome back, dear listeners. We just took a short break in that session of question and answers that Swami had with the doctors. We'll continue with the questions that were asked. Of course, now we're just picking out questions which were interesting and which probably would lead to an interesting discussion. Well, we have time, we'll go back to the ones which we leave out too. The next set of questions is on the topic of non-violence. In fact, there are three questions being asked, and probably it's understandable the context in which it is coming. You know, this is the 1960s, the time when many of these African countries were undergoing their transformation from being colonial states to republics.
And also it was a time when a decade has passed right. since India became independent. And India's independent movement was headed by Mahatma Gandhi,
right.
who was a firm believer in non-violence.
Exactly.
And ironically, the believer of the greatest apostle of non-violence had been assassinated quite brutally.
Right.
So it is natural that questions on non-violence arise. I think probably Prem, just to make a more fruitful discussion, we can read out all the three questions and the answers and then begin our discussion.
Right. So the first question in that series is, can non-violence win over all opposition? And Swami's answer was, of course it can. Only you must have unshakable faith. You should not start compromising and discovering excuses for transgressing it. The second question was, but Swamiji, people seem to have forgotten the apostle of non-violence so soon, even in his own country. And Swami answers, how do you know? How do you worry? Why do you worry over another's memory? If you feel that a certain line of behavior is good, remember it yourself. That is the best you can do to promote the cause you love. Why should you assume responsibility for straightening the world? Straighten yourself. If each one is good and does good, the world becomes good. The third question was, but Swamiji, on account of that non-violence, India was divided. On account of that non-violence, India was divided and the two parts are hating each other. Swami replied, the principle is not at fault, the people who had no faith in it. It was just an external decoration. Moreover, geographical nearness has nothing to do with the nearness of the heart. We must be dear to each other, however far we are geographically. Be near and dear, be far and dear. Be near and dear,
be far and dear. And so dear. Irrespective of the distance,
right.
be dear.
That is the duty of man. All must be loved and adored as temples where God is installed.
As you said, it clearly points out to the times, those times. See, most of, though it is East Africa, though Swami is interacting with doctors there, it's evident that most of them are Indians. So they are deeply connected to Indian history. And these were really times just after some of the most troubled period for India, when the partition took place, there were riots and so many got killed. So people began to question the efficacy of Ahimsa itself. That is why, you know, Swami answers. It's amazing that when Mahatma Gandhi was shot, for the bullet that was shot into him, in return, his response was, Hey Ram. You know, he took the name of God. That is, I think, what Swami is alluding to when he says that non-violence definitely can win over all opposition, but you should not find small excuses to stop practicing violence. Non-violence, I mean. For example, here people are saying, you know, Gandhiji practiced non-violence, what is the use? He died. And so therefore I don't want to practice, you know. Mm. There itself you are trying to find an excuse. So clearly Swami points it out, because, you know, when it comes to God, like as you said, the wealth management company, you know, imagine if I say that, okay, I hand over to the wealth management company, but next day I come and tell, you know what, the stock market has fallen, what has happened to my money? Oh God, it has reduced. You said you'll give me 15% return. It has already fallen by 1% today. How can you do? I mean, if I start doing that, you know, I feel you can't keep doing forecasting based on real-time data. That is where faith comes in. You know, in fact, today I was reading on some of the investment practices.
Mm-hmm.
There are two kinds of mutual funds in India. One is tax-saving type. One is a normal type.
Right.
The tax saving fund basically gives you a exemption benefit when it comes to your income tax.
Mm-hmm.
But it also comes with a condition that your money is locked up for 3 years.
Right.
So, a fund manager handling a tax saving fund, he's telling that I'm at an advantage because I'm assured that irrespective of what happens in the market up and down, no, for 3 years these guys can't pull out their money. So, you know, they may curse me and say, what, you know, it's all gone down, whatever, but they can't pull out their money. And in 3 years' time, I'm sure I will, because I know the wisdom with what I'm doing. So if a normal human fund manager speaks like this, how will God be saying, you know, you have entrusted your, if you entrust your life with me saying, for lifetimes, I'm yours. And you sit on a daily basis, you say, Swami, but I gave my hand, what is happening, what happened? Don't. There will be ups and downs. Whether the stock market, whether your wealth, whether your relationship and everything will be up and down. But when you take a large picture, you see the overall trend is upwards or downwards. With God, it will always be upward. But Swami says you should stop doing this. Because when we start finding excuses to not follow non-violence or for that matter any other virtue, it is because we are doing real-time analysis and forecasting. Saying that, oh, now this didn't happen, now that didn't happen. No, hold on. Give it some time period and you will see the benefits. So, you know, it's like that story of a few monkeys that learned how to do gardening.
Mm-hmm.
And the gardener told them that the most important aspect of the tree is the root.
Right.
If the root is taken care, everything will be fine. When he comes back after a year, there's no garden and the monkeys say that what you said is rubbish. So he said, what happened? He said, the monkeys reply that you said that the root is so important. So every day we would be plucking the plant to check whether the root is growing. Because the root grows, you said everything is fine. Then the gardener is shocked. He says, every day you're plucking out the plant? He says, yes. He says, if you start shaking and plucking the root every day, when are you giving it chance to grow? You just water the plant and know that the more you water and the proper fertilizers if you put, the root is definitely going to grow. And that is faith. You know, the monkeys here refer to our monkey mind. If at every instant we start pulling, tugging at the roots of faith and checking whether it is beneficial or not, we will end up with just mud and stones. If we want to harvest the fruits of jnana, we need to have faith and know that I just need to keep watering and putting fertilizers, the tree will definitely grow.
I don't know whether our discussion is going too much into investment, but it reminds me of another thing which another brilliant businessman used to say, James
Sinclair. It is definitely because, Prem, I feel the easiest way to understand karma is through deposits and...
Yeah, exactly. In fact, James Sinclair used to say that. There's one sentence which he used to keep repeating. I've heard him say that in the interview, in the talk which he gave in Swami's presence. He would keep saying the business of business and the business of life is one and the same. Right? And he would tell, when Professor Venkatraman asked him, what is it that you learned from Swami? He said, Swami gives us only two instructions.
Mm.
Swami says, watch, be happy. He says, these are the only two instructions that Swami gives us. Which means, watch without being involved. Just see your life going as it is. And in every situation, be happy. That's all it is. And he said, this you can do only if you have faith in Swami. Only if you have the surrender that it is all going to be taken care of. As you're saying, on a daily basis, it might be going up and down. But I know that 3 years down the line, when I'm actually going to get my returns, I'm going to get my, you know, due without, I will not have any complaints. So that ability to have that faith that end of the day it's all going to be fine, only that will be giving you this wisdom to stop and just watch without getting involved and be happy through that entire process, whether it's up or down. And he would say that this works exactly well for my business as well as it works for me in daily life.
Naturally, you see, even when these wealth management companies come and tell you for investments, one of the first piece of advice they give is, when the things start going down, when things start going bad,
that is
the time you should not give up. Please continue what you are doing. Because when the going is good, it is easy to do it. But when the going gets bad, that is when if you continue to invest, you will reap the maximum benefits.
Mm-hmm.
Because when the going is good, everybody invests, the amount of benefit is not big. When the going is bad, that is when. And that is precisely the thing where we falter in our spiritual life also. When the going is good, yeah, I worship, I believe in Swami, I have full faith. When the going gets a little bad, I start wondering whether I should withdraw my deposits or my investment in Swami. Should I possibly seek another guru? Should I possibly seek another God? This is what we do. We change our fund, we change our fund manager. You know, we do these things. That is why, as you say, as Sinclair says, the business of life and the business of business are absolutely the same. Therefore, there is a lot to learn, and even when it comes to non-violence, Swami says, that's why hold on. When things become difficult, hold on. And the next one, when they say that, but Swami, you know, Gandhiji held on and he was shot, the apostle of non-violence himself got subjected to violence, so Swami says, see, that is not yours. You have no idea. You have no idea what is each person's karma, what is each person's role, or how he took it. For instance, this is a very popular example that I always love. When the students asked Swami, why is that Mirabai suffered so much though she took Krishna's name? Swami's response was, did Mirabai tell you she suffered? You are thinking she suffered. Mirabai herself had to tell, she'll tell, I am in bliss, I am not suffering at all. You are concluding something about somebody, you never know what it is. You're telling that your faith in Ahimsa has been shattered because Gandhiji was killed. Possibly if you can speak to Gandhiji, he will still say that, no, I don't, my faith has not got shattered. You know,
interestingly, in fact, Meera sings in that bhajan, which was Swami's favorite bhajan, you know. She says, Janam Janam ki poonji pai, jag mein sab kho aayo, Ram Ratan dhan paayo. She says, I've lost everything in life, but I've found something which actually takes lifetimes to find. She says, I've lost everything in my worldly life, but I found something which people take, you know, generations and births and births and births to find. And that's how fortunate I am. And as you're saying, from Swami's point of view, she never complained to me. Why are you complaining?
Exactly.
About it?
We complain and we make excuses for not being good. I'm reminded of another question. I think, you know, that students would also ask Swami, that Swami, if you want to transform the world with students, there are so few students, there is so much, you know, so much happening in the world out there. It's like, Swami, you need to start possibly another 10 universities, then generate that critical mass or to transform the world. It reminds me of a scene from a movie, you know. Mm-hmm. The movie is called Force 10 from Navarone. It's a World War II movie, and basically the climax comes to a point where a bridge that the enemy forces are using has to be destroyed so that you are saved, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the people, the heroes of the movie do not have enough sufficient explosives to blast this bridge. So they come up with a plan that upriver we will blast a dam. And when this dam is blasted, the river water that comes, it will come with such a force, that force will be enough to wipe out this bridge. So they execute this plan, and there is this expert at explosives, and he sees that they don't even have enough sufficient explosives to blast the dam. But still he is confident, so he goes and sets up these explosives, and you can see having planted his explosives, they all run away to a safe place, and this guy is sitting lazily on the branch of a tree, and he says, okay, let's trigger the explosion. They trigger the explosion. There are a few toop 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 explosions, and you know what? There are cracks in the dam through which water starts flowing out, but nothing happens to the dam. The dam holds, it stands. And everybody starts criticizing this explosives guy, saying that, you know, we undertook such risk, we did all this, and at the end of it, you have created 30-40 streams. I mean, little streams. What is not going to happen? He just says, when are the enemies going to attack? Tomorrow morning, right? Break of dawn. Let's relax then. Let's sleep. And, you know, much to everybody's chagrin, this guy sleeps off. But what happens is, as the hours pass, the water starts going through those little gaps in the dam. And through the flow of water, the things start getting eroded, and within a few hours, suddenly in an instant, the whole dam crumbles down. Because these are vital points in that structure, which make the whole dam vulnerable, because water has its own force. Water has its ability to bring down things. And just before the enemy can cross over the bridge, the dam comes down, the water comes in great force and wipes out the bridge. Seeing this, you know, it inspires that this is possibly what Swami is doing. At critical points, with critical people, with some places, he's making that impact so that each one of us who feel that we have been impacted become like those holes that allow the water to pass through. We allow Swami's goodness to flow through us. We may wonder what is the use of a few holes allowing this goodness to flow through when the whole superstructure is still unaffected. Instead of getting discouraged, I think we should allow that goodness to keep flowing through, because it's a matter of time when just these amount of holes in the dam is enough to bring down the whole dam, and there will be a surging swell of goodness flowing all around.
The other thing which strikes me when I'm reading this part, when Swami is telling that yes, non-violence works, and you know, you might see somebody in the life of Mahatma Gandhi, or you might even see the consequences of how India got its independence, like we'll come to that next part where he's talking about the conflict between India and Pakistan, which was created at the end of a non-violent struggle, which became so violent in the end. So the question is, doesn't non-violence give rise to more violence in that sense?
It's almost like non-violence is suppressing your instinct so that when it gets released, it comes out with even greater fury later.
Right. I mean, it really doesn't, it takes away the value of that non-violence altogether. So something which Swami would say, especially when he's talking about the avatar comes for the establishment of dharma. Swami would often say this, there is never a decline of dharma. There's only a decline in the practice of dharma, right? So in that sense, that which is righteous, those qualities which are noble and righteous, there's never a decline in the qualities as such. There's only a decline in the number of people who are practicing that quality. So in that sense, Swami is saying, will non-violence give you benefit? Of course it will. Is non-violence noble? No, non-violence is the most noble. Swami would say, ahimsa paramo dharma. But there are people who probably don't practice it in the way it has to be practiced. That's why Swami is saying, if it is practiced with that complete faith, it will give its thing. So there is no problem with the quality as such. There is no problem with the approach as such. But seeing the others who are lacking in that principle and completeness, because I mean, we will not go into the political debate of non-violence and all of that. But one of the things which the other party, which you know, people like Tilak, people like Subhash Chandra Bose, who were against the idea of non-violence per se, is that, see, you are standing by non-violence, but you are allowing our Indian army people to be a part of the British army. So where is that non-violence? In a very tacit way, you are being an approver to the war which is happening. That was something which they were against, because they said this is doublespeak. At home, you are saying non-violence, but your non-violence is leading to your Indian people fighting in the army. Right? So in that sense, maybe Swami is saying that it is not completely followed the way it has to be followed. And there is a place and time for it. I mean, that, again, that's a debate which can go on. But the thing is, the quality as such, the practice as such is pure. And Swami says, definitely, you can achieve everything if you practice that in the right earnest.
In the life of Gautam Buddha, I'm reminded of this because just a week ago, we had the Buddha Purnima celebrations in Prashanti. And this was very the theme of the celebrations, Ahimsa Paramo Dharma. And if you look at the life of Gautam Buddha, there's a story of Angulimala, the vicious robber who would, his name Angulimala comes from the fact that he makes a mala or garland out of Anguli, or the fingers of people whom he has massacred. And he just melted in the presence of Buddha's Ahimsa. So when practiced perfectly, it always works. As you rightly put it, there is no problem in the value of Ahimsa. There is a problem in the way it is practiced. To the extent it is practiced, it gives its benefits. If it is not practiced properly, naturally the benefits are not proper. So I think that's beautifully answered by Bhagwan. And with that, we'll move on to the next question.
But just before that, I think that point which Swami is making about nearness and dearness.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
It's very, very important, because, I mean, many times I look at especially this, the conflict between India and Pakistan. I mean, there is probably no two countries which are so similar in many ways. You know, we share the same history. We share not just the immediate history or colonial history. We share history which goes back to centuries.
Ancient history, medieval history and modern history.
Exactly.
We share same geographies.
Our civilizations actually come from the same point. And I mean, most of our ancient Indian civilization is actually in the present day Pakistan. So in that sense, there are no two countries which are so alike. But why is it that there's so much of conflict? Because as Swami clearly says, now we think they are different from us. You know, this idea that they are far from us, or they are different from us, or they are distinct and they are not likable for anymore. I mean, even though there is so much similar, right? Because invariably, even when two people get married, when there is actually a difference in opinion, when there's a difference in culture, when there's a difference in lifestyle, that's when the problem arises. But here are two countries in so many ways. Of course, there are distinctions, but in so many ways we are alike. As people, we are alike in tradition in so many ways, but still we have this feeling that they are enemies and we are this. And Swami says that it doesn't matter whether you're close, you're far, doesn't matter if you're similar or you're dissimilar. If you think that they are not dear, that's where all the problem starts.
Exactly, Prema. When you were giving the marriage example, I was just thinking, if you have the husband and wife sharing similar interests in everything, when there is dearness, they are celebrating it, saying that, you know what, we are so similar, and they are thrilled. If they are totally opposite, you know, but there is dearness, guess what? Still there it is celebrated. You know, what Swami says is so correct. It doesn't matter whether you are similar or dissimilar. When there is dearness, it is always celebration. You celebrate the diversity or you celebrate the oneness. Absolutely. But it is celebration is there. But when there is no dearness, then if you are similar, it becomes boring. What is this here? It's like I'm marrying myself. It's so terrible. And if you are different, so whether there is oneness or diversity, if there is no dearness, it becomes a cause for problems. So as Swami so beautifully put it, it is wrong to, you know, blame and say ahimsa is the cause for separation. Because Swami says that separation has happened only on the political map. And even if it is a separation, it is only affecting the nearness. Okay, possibly you now need to get a visa to go there. But the dearness is not there, right? Dearness is something that has to be focused upon and not the nearness.
And Swami clearly says it was because people looked at this principle of nonviolence as an external decoration, right? I mean, that quality did not necessarily seep into the billion people who belong to, you know, the Indian subcontinent. You can't have just one leader talking about nonviolence and expect an entire nation to believe in it and follow in it. So Swami says it's not the mistake of the principle, it's the mistake of the people.
With that, we move on to the next question. The next question, again, you know, it is different, but very interesting, definitely. It's something to do with Hinduism not propagating conversions. Right. I think that was the next question.
So we'll read that question. I think it's a short answer. We'll talk about that. The question is, why does not Hinduism establish proselytizing missions? And that is the question. I mean, as you explained, proselytizing is
conversion
from one religion to the other. And Swami replies, the reason is Hinduism has no boundaries or limits. It is only when you have limits that you try to overstep them and try to bring those beyond into the fold. It has no aliens. All are pilgrims trudging along the same road towards the same shrine. Their paces may be different, but their goal is the same.
There, Swami answers so beautiful. Why doesn't Hinduism encourage conversion? Because Swami says conversion is if you feel that this is our people, those are different people, then you feel the need for conversion. Oh, the different people should become like us. But if you feel all of us are the same, all of us are pilgrims trudging towards the same goal on the same road, then there is no alien. I think that's such a beautiful statement. In Hinduism, there is no alien. You know, it was very interesting what I found here. See, we often say that different religions are different paths to the same goal. Here, you know, Swami has made it different. Swami is referring to different religions and beliefs as different vehicles on the same road to the same goal. It's like I'm headed from Bangalore to Puttaparthi. There is the same national highway, AH-43 that I take. Different religions are like the cars or buses or the carts or the cycle which are there, you know. It's almost like Swami saying, no problem. You can do the entire journey in a car or you can do half journey in a bus and then get down half in the car. You know, this is what my mind is extending. So it just means that it doesn't matter actually whether for half your life you're a Hindu and then you feel that Islam is better or you're a Muslim and you feel Christianity is better, you convert to a Buddhist. All that doesn't matter because it's just different pace, you know. I feel this is a different, new perspective that I hadn't got before. Like, I always considered different religions to be different paths to the same goal. But Swami is now referring to different religions and different beliefs as different paces on the same paths to the same goal.
The beauty is, you know, even when we're talking about the act of conversions in Hinduism, a pretty worrying trend is something similar to that is coming into Hinduism also. And if you look at it, why the other religions tend, were doing that is, it comes out of insecurity. When you feel that people are leaving your folds and going away, you want to bring them back. And I think it's the same insecurity now in some, some groups in Hinduism started feeling it. But when you realize that it is coming from insecurity, in fact, if you read the history of Kerala, Kerala, the first Syrian church was set up in Kerala much, much before, I think, any other religion actually came to the Indian subcontinent. But when eventually the Portuguese came, they treated the Syrian Christians as non-Christians. You know, because it was a political thing to come and rule over that place, they wanted to take over that place. So it's actually got nothing to do with religion, it's got nothing to do with, it becomes a groupism, you know, my group, you leave my group, then I gather more groups into my, this one. In fact, one of our boys who had been to, I think, the Kumbh, the Mahakumbh, which was there recently, he was telling the sad thing is many of these so-called yogis and sadhus, they will put up that pandal, and all the time they will be marketing themselves and they will be trying to gather more chelas under them. They will say, I have 200 chelas, I have 300 chelas. And they'll say, no, he has only this, or I've chanted so many crore times the Ram Nam, and that group has only done this much, and we have written it. So it, it stems from totally the human nature. It's got nothing to do with divine. And if you look at it, when Swami is talking about Hinduism, it's literally the point of view of God, right? When Swami looks at all of us, Swami will not feel that, oh, because you're coming to me only from this route, you are less important to me. And Hinduism was trying to talk about that broad-mindedness when you see from God's point of view and not from the pilgrim's point of view. When you see from the pilgrim's point of view, there'll always be marketing. You know, mine is better. I've done this. This is the best thing to do. That's what we always do. A bhajan singer will always talk of bhajan singing as the best path. A sevadal will talk of seva being the best path. But from Swami's point of view, every path is equally important. And as long as you have the craving and, you are worth the journey and the destination.
You know, when Swami said that Hinduism doesn't seek to convert because there's no alien, I just got curious and, I went online to search for how do I convert into a Hindu? I searched. And I found a WikiHow page.
Okay.
WikiHow page on how to convert to Hinduism. Okay. And it was an 18-step process. I said, oh my God, I am a Hindu all my life. I only didn't know that there's a process in which somebody can convert into Hindu. Let me look. As I opened the page, the first statement there on the page, it says, there is no official conversion process or ceremony for converting into the Hindu faith. That's the first sentence. And then, two sentences later it says, Hinduism preaches the very principle that there is no need for conversion. And that the wisdom of the universe is available to all only if they are willing to seek it. So then I was thinking, then what on earth are you listing 18 points? So after that they say, but there are some practices which Hindus do. So if you like, you can just start doing them. For example, one, picking up a god and worshipping. Two, start doing yoga at home. Three, do jyoti meditation. They're just giving out some traditional practices that are done. And said, possibly you can start doing this because there's no official conversion. So I'm very happy and glad that even though years and decades have rolled by, it is, it has still held on, that thing that is as old as culture itself, the Sanatana Dharma still holds on, saying that you don't need a process to convert, because when you are already that, when each and every one of us are already seekers of truth, what is the need to label myself as, now I am a special seeker of truth or something like that? Everyone is a seeker of truth, and therefore there is no need of any kind of conversion.
And really, if you go to the history of Hinduism, that's when you find these so many paths which are available, which are so distinct, but all come under the umbrella of Hinduism, because it said that as long as you're seeking, website so beautifully said, as long as you have the intention to seek, you fall under the category of someone who is a religious person. Like there is that famous tradition of, I think, Charvaka, as they call
Charvaka,
right, Charvaka philosophy. That speaks about materialism. It says there is no tomorrow, there is no karma, there is nothing like past birth and all that. And there is a famous...
borrow money, eat ghee.
Right, borrow money and drink ghee. Right. It says even if it means that you need to borrow to enjoy life, do that. Because life is for enjoyment. And even that was allowed to flourish under the umbrella of Hinduism with the belief, if you read some of the other sages, They said, see, this is a very ephemeral way of trying to approach life, and eventually it will fall away. And that's what we see today. Today, of course, that Charvaka philosophy has got into all of us, but you don't have that as a school of approach, a school of Hinduism. And because they believe that if it is not valid, it will fall away with time. And I think that is the confidence which symbolizes Hinduism. That Swami is saying,
what is eternal will be eternal. Yeah. What is not eternal, need not worry about wiping it out because it will fall away with time.
Right. So I think we'll take another break before we go through the remaining questions. Not all of them, some of them. And before we conclude this week's episode.
फिजाओं में खुले प्यार की खुशबू का एहसास हो तो आशियाना हमारा है तुझसे ऐसा है हर दिल की आस हो तो
Sai Maa.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We are so engrossed and enjoying these different question and answers that many times we don't notice the time and the minutes ticking by. Possibly we just have enough time for just another question. We'll see if we can squeeze in two. But the next question that these doctors asked Swami was about acquiring bliss, acquiring ananda. Because whatever we do in life, day-to-day life, as mundane things like brushing or washing face, from that to as profound things as meditation and whatever, all that is because we are in the pursuit of happiness. So that they come almost directly to the point and they ask Swami, Swami, what should we do to acquire ananda?
Right. So the question goes like this. How can we acquire ananda, Swamiji, the spiritual bliss? And Swami's reply is, ananda is not something you can acquire or procure from somewhere outside you or from someone other than you. It is in you. All the time, it is your genuine nature. You are ananda. That is why I address you as ananda swarupa. When you experience ananda, it is prapta prapti, getting that already got, not a prapta prapti, getting the not got. This gentleman here with a book needs, let us say, 5 shillings urgently. He asks the doctor sitting by his side to lend him the sum. The doctor agrees, but even as he is saying so, he takes the book casually into his hand and turning over the pages, he finds between the leaves a 5 shilling note. He gives it back to the owner saying, you do not need a loan now. This is yours. You had it all this while, only you did not know you had it. This is the getting the already got. Ananda is got like this. The guru or spiritual master or preceptor reveals to you the treasure of ananda which you had, but which you had forgotten or neglected or discarded or never knew of.
So beautiful. It brings to my mind another analogy that Bhagwan often gives. It's so beautiful. He says that there is a sculptor sitting and chiseling a rock. And after his work is done, you see the beautiful idol of Lord Krishna. You go and prostrate to that idol, to that stone idol of Lord Krishna. And then Swami says that this, we call it as the creator of the sculptor. But if you ask the sculptor will say that I did not create this Krishna. This Krishna is already there in the stone. I just chipped away those parts which are not Krishna, and Krishna stood revealed. So also, you know, here Swami is saying, ananda is there in you, just like Krishna is there in that rock. It is just that it is hidden from your sight because of so many things that are not Krishna, that are not ananda, that are not eternal, that are not you, that you are mistaking it to be you, you know. That is what is maya. So once the veil is moved, once all those things that are not you are chipped away from you, that is your ahankara, your mamakara, your attachment, your all these things which are not actually you, but you confuse them to be yourselves. Once those are all chipped away, just as the idol of Lord Krishna stands revealed, your ananda stands revealed to you, and that ananda is the spiritual bliss that you're talking about.
Well, if that is the spiritual bliss, which is the ultimate thing, there's another analogy which Swami himself gives, you know, it's about the dog which starts biting the dry bone. And Swami would say that it's so vigorously biting into that bone that the bone actually pokes into its gum. And the dog's gums are bleeding, but the dog thinks that the bone has become juicy and it starts, you know, chewing harder. Swami says the same thing when you seek happiness outside. When you do a certain thing, actually it draws the happiness from within, but you are thinking that that happiness is actually coming from that object and you pursue it even harder.
I remember, you know, somebody was saying that you think that a Mercedes-Benz car gives you joy, but that is as long as it's parked in your compound.
One wall on the other side
and it gives rise to envy and jealousy. So if Mercedes-Benz was a source of happiness, then I think I should lay down on the pavement beside a Mercedes-Benz showroom. I should just keep looking and feeling happy. It is not. The happiness is actually coming from myself and not from that object.
Right. And, I mean, many times when you see, that is what is the beauty of the human body. Swami would say when he's talking about the senses and the body, many times the happiness is actually fit into something which will give you purpose in life. Like a classic example that Swami would give is food. When it smells good, you get attracted to it. The same food, when it becomes stale, it actually smells bad. So your senses are repulsed from it because you're not supposed to eat it. And when it smells good, you're supposed to eat it because it's going to give you nourishment. So pleasure is attached to something which will give you a purpose. A similar thing, like suppose there's a little boy whose father is probably a millionaire. All the father's property actually belongs to him. But, you know, the mother will put him on some errand. She'll say, you know, go to the shop and get me this, or clean up your room. And sometimes you'll tip the little child for doing what you're supposed to do, right? The money is already yours because you're the heir to all the property. But the parents will make you do something which is probably good for you and reward you with the same thing which is already yours. And I think that's the same thing which happens with all of us. You know, we are supposed to do some things. As now they say scientifically, one of the best ways to be happy is to exercise regularly. If you do that morning exercise regularly, it seems there's so much of happiness which comes out of it. Clearly showing that exercise is good for you and there is a happiness hidden in that exercise. So typically, God has put it in such a way that you go around doing things which make you happy. Don't overdo it, because then it becomes, as Swami would say, anything goes beyond the limit, it becomes harmful. So do within limits and you will keep deriving that happiness, which will eventually go into that, the higher state of happiness, which is literally like the reservoir from which you've been drawing. And suddenly you realize, oh, I've struck the whole reservoir. You know, I don't need to do anything to get it now.
And as you rightly said, it is also built, see, though you say that when you do exercise, it releases happiness. If I over-exercise, it makes me fatigued and takes away the happiness.
Right.
So I think that's also built in. Swami has ensured that, God has ensured that whatever you're doing, when you do it within limits only, it gives happiness.
In fact, in a recent discourse which I happened to hear, very beautiful statement Swami makes. The famous statement, Nashreyo Niyamam Vina, Swami says. Right? Nashreyo Niyamam Vina means there is no welfare without boundaries. So even for anything that you do, there should be done within limits. And the next statement which Swami made in this course is, Swami says, even for Niyamam there should be a Niyamam.
Even for limits there should
even
be a limit.
Even for limits there should be a limit. Even for discipline there need to be a limit. You cannot lead an extremely disciplined life and imagine that you can be happy that way. I mean, that's such a profound thing. You need discipline to find happiness. And even for that discipline, there should be limits.
So basically, everything has to be limits. And you can't do anything to the extreme. I mean, you can't be... even extreme discipline is bad.
Right.
I remember the other satsang we had on the ceiling of desires.
Mm-hmm.
And that time, I think this discussion came up. It was very fruitful where we discovered there's nothing like good or bad in the universe. The only thing that defines good and bad, possibly from our perspective, is that anything done in excess is bad. Anything that is within limits is good. Because, you know, like alcohol. Too much of it is bad, but a little amount of it helps in giving warmth. It's there in many medicines. It is the base for many cough syrups, you know. It is there. So, temperature. Swami gives the example of bodily temperature. We say fever is bad. But you know what, if my body temperature goes below 97, 96 degrees Fahrenheit, that's also bad. So neither is cold good nor heat good. It's always within limits. If it goes below the limits, if it exceeds one extreme, that is bad. If it exceeds the other extreme, that is also bad. So like you said, yes, even discipline needs to be disciplined.
And the way Swami puts it, you know, whether it's a master, a preceptor or a spiritual guru, what he does is he gives you what was already yours. Like what they say about business consultants, you know. You pay a business consultant, it is like paying somebody to look at your watch and tell you the time on your watch. Right? Swami is saying literally like that, they give you what is already yours. And that analogy Swami gave was so beautiful. He says somebody borrows a book from you, and then when you go to ask that person for some money, that person finds that in the book that you have given him, there is the exact sum that you are asking. He takes it and gives it to you. And he says, this is always yours, but you didn't know that it was there in this book. And that typically describes what the question and the answer was about.
And the key word there, I feel, is when Swami is saying, you are made aware of it because you have either discarded it or forgotten it. And that is the root cause for all the misery, because Swami says, you forget that you are Anand Swarupalara, or you are discarding it. And by discarding it, I mean, when we go to ahankara and mamakara, we are discarding happiness, or we have just forgotten because of maya.
Exactly. I mean, that example of the Mercedes car being on the other side of the compound purely comes out of the feeling that this is my compound and that's not my compound. Right? Only when the division comes, when there is that story, I think it's Swami Chinnakatha, says that there is this man who has lost his wife and he's crying endlessly. He's saying, I'm very, very upset. A spiritual master comes there and he asks him, why are you so, despondent? Why are you crying? And the man says, I lost my wife. But why are you crying for that? So he says, what do you mean? My wife has died and the death is the cause of my grief. So he says, no, death is not the cause of your grief, because there is a death happening every month in your village. You don't feel the same way for everybody. The whole problem is because you think that that lady was my wife. You know, that belonging is what is causing the problem. And that's what Swami is saying here, in the sense of, the whole problem is you've forgotten it, and that forgetting has happened through by saying only this is mine and that is not mine, or saying that only what I have and I can call mine, I will be happy about.
Exactly. And as you said, that becomes a source for our joy as well as sorrow. You know, you see a damaged car and you don't feel anything. Then they say, you know, actually your car only, your friend had bought. Oh God, you know, the moment you get to know it's your car, you feel sad. Every day, for example, you know, you get to know of people winning lotteries. Possibly you just read it and don't feel anything at all. But the moment it is you, you feel somehow, you know, if lottery were to give joy, you should feel the joy every day, right? I mean, I think that is what expansion love makes us. If we are in expansion love mode, we will always be empathetic because everybody's pain becomes our pain. And we'll always be joyful because everybody's joy is our joy. I think that is the kind of life Swami led. And I think that is the kind of life we should also lead. I think now the time is quite late and we will not be able to go further into questions. But dear listeners, do send us your feedback. Do share with us what you felt, because there was another day when Swami spoke to some other people, some other groups, and those questions and answers are also available with us. If this is something you feel as we have felt, that it is something very fruitful, then do write to us, because after we do the Bhagavata Vahini Satsang, we'll possibly take it up and continue it if it is found to be beneficial to a large number. With that, we bring this satsang to a close, offering it at the lotus feet of our beloved Bhagwan. We will end with a song as always, and on the other side of it, you will have Brother Chandu with his segment Love to Love.
Thank you.